Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today, I don't often get a chance to say this, but my guest today is undoubtedly a rising star amongst British mountaineering and climbing circles. She's climbing incredibly hard and some really doing amazingly well in competitive climbing, but she's also a journalist and a translator. And how she's crammed that all in over the last few years, I don't know. Hello, Natalie. How are you doing? Natalie Berry.
Good, thanks. How are you, John?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm fine. As I say, I'm a bit stiff after the gym, but I can move around a little bit. Can you tell me, am I right in thinking you're from Glasgow? Is that where you come from?
I was actually born in Liverpool and then moved to Glasgow when I was three. So
okay. Well, you can't. I come from Merseyside. We won't hold it against you. You know. So tell me. I think you started to climb, as far as I can see, almost before you could walk. How old were you when you began climbing?
I started climbing when I was about eight. I just got into it completely by chance. There was a mobile climbing wall at a shopping centre in sort of in the outskirts of Glasgow, and I just saw it, wanted to have a go, tried it, and then the very next day I was off to a kids club at the Glasgow Climbing Centre.
Oh, amazing. So it was one of these, was it one of those ones, the little walls that moves, or was it one of the, like on the back of a cart or something?
Yeah, like one of those towers, those mobile towers
I've
that
got
drive
you
around.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so it shows you that that kind of thing can inspire people. And then when you went to the Glasgow Climbing Centre then, you were sort of brought along by them in terms of developing your climbing, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I went to the kids club and my dad learned to belay. And back in the day, this was about 15 or 20 years ago now, there weren't really that many girls climbing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was unusual. There were still enough kids, but there wasn't really as much in the way of youth development as there is today. I think it's definitely progressed a lot, especially in the last 5 to 10 years. But yeah, it was the only way really that I could have got into it, because my family aren't outdoorsy or especially sporty.
Okay.
It was just a good inroad for me, really.
So was your dad a bit surprised when he had his daughter scaling these great walls then?
Yeah, I think I expressed an interest in trying it at the shopping centre, and my parents were a bit reluctant, but yeah, they've supported me. Like, I think I still scare them from time to time.
I'm sure you do. Yeah. You scare me from some of the things I've seen you do. But yeah, that sounds really good. And I think that's a really good example of how the development of indoor climbing centres has really helped promote and given people an opportunity. Yeah, when you got into climbing, you said, you know, there weren't many girls about. Was that a barrier to you?
I wouldn't say so. I think I was always, I don't really like to describe it in this way, but like a tomboy in some sense. Like, I didn't feel like I had to do the activities that other girls were doing. I just kind of did what I wanted. Like, I was always playing in the garden, going on my bike, and
yeah,
I was just quite sporty and athletic. So once I realized that I had an aptitude for it and enjoyed it, I thought, okay, there's not many other girls, but does it matter? Like, I was competing, the first competition I did, I was essentially in a category on my own. I was the only girl, but I just thought, yeah, I'll do it and I'll try and compare myself against the boys and just try and beat the boys. That's kind of how it started.
Oh, right. And how was the, I don't know, there's not a word for it, really. So how did the climbing establishment accept you in those days? Or did it not?
I never felt, like, pushed out. I think maybe some people were quite surprised that I was enjoying it so much and challenging the boys. But there were other girls climbing. Like, I was kind of following in the footsteps of Hazel Finley, Katie Whittaker, Gemma Powell, Emma Twyford, who are all still climbing today.
Yes.
So I did have role models, and like people like Lucy Creamer, and then obviously French climbers like Catherine d'Estaville and people like Lena Hill. So I wasn't without role models. It was just, you know, in that specific like competition climbing scene, there weren't as many in Scotland. But today it's totally different. There's probably, I think actually they have more female entrants in youth competitions than male a lot of the time, which is really good.
Is that right? Yeah. That's great. That's great. That's fantastic. Well, I you know, you always like to think that one of the it's not entirely true that climbing and mountaineering have been one of the few sports that have largely accepted women. I think obviously going back to, you know, 70 or 80 years, there was obviously quite a lot of prejudice then, but there's no reason you know, why clubs and that I've always accepted women. I think that where, I mean, some of the older clubs didn't accept women for quite a long time, but I think that's changed now. Thank God.
Yeah. I think the issue is a lot of the time women have just been more or less overlooked or ignored. There's been women like Gwen Moffat and Dorothy Pilley, women who've done lots of climbing and pioneering ascents, but you don't hear about them as much because other people don't write about them, and it often takes a woman writing about herself, which sounds maybe stereotypical to say it, but I think women are probably less inclined to write about themselves compared to men. So I think that's definitely plays a factor in why there's been so few accounts of what women have got up to over the years.
Yeah, there's probably some truth in that. I mean, I think it's quite okay for men to push themselves forward, but in the sort of stereotypical image of what women should be, then, and that's maybe not quite so acceptable is the wrong word, but it's not so much the norm is probably true. Well, that you know, obviously that kind of brings us on really to the work that you've done in hello.
Yep, I'm here.
There's a minor explosion at the other end.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I don't know if I hit something.
Maybe. Don't worry about it. That sort of brings us on to the work you've done in translating Elizabeth Revol's book, To Live. Can you tell me what that book's about? Or give us a little, sort of, in a nutshell, what the story is of that woman climber?
Yeah, so Elizabeth Revol, she's a French mountaineer, and in January 2018, she went to Nanga Parbat in Pakistan. It's an 8,000 meter peak with her partner Tomek Matskiewicz. They were aiming to do a winter ascent of the mountain, which had actually already been done the year before, but this was Thomas's 7th attempt at the mountain, I think, and Elizabeth's 4th attempt in winter. So it was just a bit of an obsession for both of them.
Right.
And this account, To Live, just tells Elizabeth's story of climbing the mountain, reaching the summit. But unfortunately, Tomek became ill on the summit. He couldn't see. He developed high altitude sickness. They tried to descend. And unfortunately, Tomek's condition he couldn't be rescued, essentially. Elizabeth had to effectively rescue herself and descend from the mountain alone, where she was met by some rescuers from a climbing team that was climbing on K2 nearby. So really, it's just, an ascent, an account of climbing a mountain, losing a partner, and then her kind of process of coming to terms with survivor's guilt, post-traumatic stress disorder, because as you can imagine, it was a really difficult situation to be in.
Yeah, you can't really.
Just how she moved on from it all, really, because there was also a massive debacle in the press about leaving her partner behind and only thinking of herself and whatnot. So yeah, there's lots of different threads to the story, really.
And her partner, was it just a climbing partner, or was her partner in life?
No, he was just a climbing partner, but right. They had a obviously very close friendship.
Right. So he was a big friend of hers. And what sort of insights did it give you? I mean, you know, give you into, I suppose, climbing at that kind of level, because that's probably something that you yourself will aspire to probably tomorrow.
So, yeah,
how do you, did it alter your perception of the kind of high risk, high level climbing that is in the Himalayas?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not a mountaineer. I wouldn't really class myself as even an alpinist, really. But yeah, I just got so much respect for people who do this kind of thing, like the temperatures, the altitude, the solitude, the winds. I just couldn't imagine it. There was one night I was translating and I was in Chamonix and it was in the winter, and I opened the balcony door and it was obviously pretty cold outside, but just knowing that that was nothing compared to the conditions that Elizabeth and Tomek and people who do these kind of things, like, it was just nothing compared to what they have to withstand, and just to have the resilience to keep going and be alone on an 8,000 meter peak is just, yeah, it's crazy. I wouldn't say I necessarily got a better understanding of what it's like, but yeah, it certainly opened my eyes and gave me even more respect for them, really. Yeah.
We're sleeping with the window closed then.
Yeah.
Probably not a bad idea in Germany in the winter, I would have thought. Yeah, yeah. And so, did you think, I mean, well, you know what, the press is, any climbing incident like that, and especially something that is as high profile as that, the press sort of vitriol that they seem to unleash against anybody who's involved in something like that, and you know, what I've noticed in certainly, I suppose in climbing accidents that I've seen reported, is that there is always a tendency in the press to try to find blame, to attach fault to somebody. It was someone's mistake, someone else, someone did something wrong. Was that an element in the reporting of the accident for her, do you think?
Yeah, I think she felt guilty for leaving Tomek behind. I think people expected her to probably just stay and sit and die with him to some degree, because I think the press, if you know, a lot of the time the national press, it doesn't consist of climbers, they don't understand the nuances of, like, if she'd have stayed there, she wouldn't have survived. Like, neither of them would have survived. Mm-hmm, and but they just look for, yeah, I guess, a scapegoat. And I don't know, like, she was accused of only thinking of herself, of putting other people in danger, of being irresponsible. And I don't know.
All the sort of things that the press normally heaps on climbers who've been a bit, and that's just the nature of the beast in terms of the press, though, I think.
Yeah, I think especially given the condition she was in, you know, she weighed 45 kilos and she hadn't eaten for days or slept properly for days, and she was, you know, had really severe frostbite, and she just arrives in France to this, like, storm of press abuse, and people were like the press were queuing up in the hospital to try and get words out of her, where she could barely string a sentence together or process her thoughts. Yeah, so
horrendous,
it was very serious. And I think in some ways possibly the way the, you know, the aftermath of the ascent was in some ways worse than what she went through, or it certainly didn't help. Like, it really exacerbated her PTSD, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, often climbs like that, or when there are accidents or disasters like that, it doesn't end when you get off the mountain, does it?
No.
You know, that's not the end of the disaster. Do you think, when you were translating it, obviously, I mean, translation is not an exact process, is it? Presumably, you've got to try to say, well, you can't really quite say that in English, but maybe you'd say it this way. maybe this is what you meant to say. And how much do you think the fact that you're a woman climber, do you think that what you wrote was perhaps, you had more insight because you could perhaps identify with her better? I don't know, just wondered.
Yeah, certainly I would say, first and foremost, as a climber, that gave me the most insight and kind of technical skill with regard to the translation, because we're having to translate things like overhead knot, like the most technical stuff is like different knots in French, different climbing pieces of climbing equipment or terms relating to style and ethics in climbing. So that definitely helped. I think that was the biggest advantage I had. But yeah, maybe being a woman, I wouldn't say Elizabeth's book is overly emotive. You know, that's the cliche you would kind of expect from, oh, is it more emotional? Does she talk about how she feels? Like, she does talk about how she feels. Of course she does. And I think actually the one of the most interesting parts of the book is when she discusses the aftermath and how she goes through therapy to try and work through the PTSD
right.
and survivor's guilt. Yeah, maybe that's something that as a woman I could kind of work those thoughts into something hopefully legible.
Well, yeah.
That makes sense.
It makes sense. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think I've talked to, I interviewed, for example, Simon McCartney. And I think, you know, who took part in a couple of really extreme climbs that I think probably should have killed him, even though they didn't. I think he'd agree. I don't think he'd argue with that.
Yeah.
I think in talking to him, I mean, those climbs are about 30 years ago now. But certainly he is still dealing with the aftermath of those climbs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether there's a sense that because it's you know, for women are allowed to talk about feelings a bit easier than men, yeah. And whether actually women cope better with that, I don't know. Do you think there's any sense of that?
Yeah, I think like in the book, Elizabeth talks about, you know, having conversations with people like Catherine Destiville, you know, another female climber who's experienced loss and risk and trauma in the mountains. And she talks about her therapy sessions. Like, I haven't really heard many male mountaineers talking about having therapy.
I don't know.
Maybe, I'm sure some have, but just to be so open about it was really kind of refreshing, I think.
I think it's certainly clear to me that you know, some of the trauma that people go through is similar to that people go through in war.
Yeah.
And we're only, I suppose, we're not even very good at helping our people from our armed forces to deal with it yet, you know.
No.
So that's a particular issue. Go on.
From Elizabeth's perspective, I mean, I think the title of the book's really interesting, To Live, because I toyed with the idea of, you know, is it to live or is it to survive? You know, that
right.
Kind of,
okay.
Living in its essence, but also living life to its fullest. And I think what she talks about in her recovery, you know, you might expect someone who's gone through that not to return to the mountains ever again, and you wouldn't blame them for that. But
no.
She talks about how the mountains actually helped her in her recovery, and, you know, going back into them, like even Himalayan mountain, like she climbs Everest and Lhotse. You know, that they actually really helped her emotionally. She didn't want to leave mountaineering behind. That didn't feel right to her. So in some ways, yeah, that was a different kind of therapy that I didn't really expect. You know, when she went through that, I thought, she's never going to do that again. I wouldn't do that if I was her. But I mean, she says, she's quite candid about it. She says, you know, I don't want to do any kind of really high risk ascents again where I'm responsible for my climbing partner or they're responsible for me. That's just too much. But yeah, she has gone and done some solo ascents and she's still climbing, which I think is really commendable. And yeah, I've got a lot of respect for that.
It says a lot for what she's done to deal with those issues. And perhaps because she obviously actively worked to overcome those sort of feelings, you know, she's achieved that. So let's come back to your own climbing career. Where are you? Well, once we're allowed to actually leave the house, of course.
Yeah.
Where do you see yourself going? What are your goals? What would you like to achieve?
I'd like to do a bit more sport and trad climbing, a bit more alpine climbing at some stage, but having just moved back from Chamonix, that might not be possible in the near future. But
sure,
yeah, hopefully just live a bit more of a settled life, because I've kind of been like not really had a settled abode for the last 4 or 6 years or so. So yeah, just getting somewhere to settle and then train and be able to get out a bit more regularly to crags would be really good. And yeah, certainly no 8,000 meter peaks in the pipeline.
Not just yet. No. So when will you, I don't know, where do you see yourself getting in terms of climbing? Are you really still, you know, I know that you compete. Is that a really important part of your climbing for you?
Well, I still compete a bit, but not really professionally as such. I'm not on the British team this year. I decided I'm not going to go for that again, I don't think, because it's just too much time and money. I couldn't really balance it with work. But I'd still like to do fun competitions. Yeah, it's quite difficult to get support for competitions in the UK. So unless you're elite levels.
Yeah, did that sort of just take too much time, too much training, too much of your life?
Yeah, I had a bit of a hiatus like after the youth circuit ended for me. I had a few years out, climbed outdoors a lot, went to university, started working, and then last year did a competition for fun and got on the British team again.
Oops.
Oh dear. It was just, I really enjoyed it, but it was just with work and trying to save to buy a house and stuff. It's
I mean, to compete at a really high level, you just have to be totally dedicated to that. It has to rule in your life to the exclusion of everything else, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, you can't train.
Let's talk about your work then. You are, now then, let's see if I get this right, your editor-in-chief for ukclimbing.com, is that correct?
Yep, that's right. I've been there about 5 or 6 years now, which has gone really fast. I
bet it has, yeah. And what do you enjoy about that?
I enjoy looking for stories and trying to find stories that are a bit different to just person climbs piece of rock, person climbs. Like, obviously that's a core part of what we do, but I really like doing kind of features and interviews, finding out more about what makes people tick and kind of trends are going on, like a lot of online climbing culture. Like, I think it's quite alien to a lot of the UKC demographic, but it kind of interests.
And where do you see your writing career going? Are there any big projects that you'd like to work on? Or
not really. Like, I don't really have anything specific in mind when I say not really. But I'd like to keep writing. Maybe write more for, you know, newspapers, and other publications, because I think it's really interesting. I'd like to try and get more climbing stories into the mainstream media, but in a way that's kind of understandable to both climbers makes sense to climbers and non-climbers. I think a lot of the time you see sensationalist articles like what happened to Elizabeth and things, but you don't really get much nuance in it. And it'd be better.
It's always quite a challenge writing about climbing, I think, to write something that is accessible to someone who doesn't climb, but also conveys something to people who do climb. That's a really hard line, difficult way to find through, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like in Elizabeth Revol's case, like people don't understand what alpine style is, like why is she not using oxygen, why is she not using fixed ropes and things. So it's all that kind of detail that I think you can't expect people to understand it, I guess, but it's complicated. It's a real skill to be able to write about climbing for kind of different audiences.
So if you could, are there any climbs that you really want to do that you've set your heart on but you haven't got up yet?
I'd like, not really any specific climbs as such. I'd like to climb 8C maybe. That's always been a long term goal that I've never really got around to. There's maybe some more climbs in Scotland, like Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really got a specific list.
But, right. Yeah. Okay. I was just interested in one of the climbs that I saw that you'd done. I don't know why it appealed to me. You climbed a thing called Digital Crack.
Oh yeah, I didn't actually climb that. I tried it, but I've still not done it. But yeah, I keep meaning to go back for it.
I found the climb you've got to do, you see.
That is actually one I'd like to go back for. I tried to go back before we left, but yeah, conditions weren't great, so we had to turn around.
Tell us about that climb just briefly. It's a technical route and it's very high altitude, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's the highest 8A in Europe. Don't think it's the highest in the world anymore, but it's like, it's not actually a crack, it's more like a corner, corner slab climb, but it's really nice, and yeah, I definitely need to go back and do it.
I found your ambition now, you see. I knew you had one somewhere. So obviously, you know, you've got your climbing, you've got your journalism, and you know, your translation. What's it like translating something like did you find that difficult in places?
Yeah, I found it quite difficult because at university I wouldn't say I really took to translation, because it was like a part of the course. It wasn't, my course wasn't centered around translation, but it was part of it, because a lot of the time at university it felt very like you had a marking scheme, so even though it was a creative exercise, like each sentence was like allocated a number of points depending on how well your answer fitted.
Oh, right.
Marker's answer, and it felt a bit too like scientific for something that was meant to be creative. And a lot of the time it forced you to kind of not, maybe it forced you to think a bit too literally, whereas in translation, a lot of the time you really want to, especially when it's like a creative written account of something, want to be too literal, and you want to think about how else you could express it. So I found it quite stifling almost at university, whereas now, like working on To Live, I felt like I had more room to be expressive. And
okay,
you know, being a climber as well, I could probably relate to it a bit more. Were certain phrases, like not necessarily specific climbing phrases, but there was one, it was like the delicious freshness of snowy immensities. That's what it literally, in French, that was the literal translation. So it's like, how do you translate something like that? I think I can't remember what I put. It was something like, to do with crisp air or something, but yeah, it's difficult, like something that sounds quite poetic but just doesn't really make sense,
because there is no literal translation of that. You've got to try and get inside her head and see what she was actually thinking. The whopping white mountain might have done it, you know, but anything.
And also, yeah, there was some quite funny like mistakes or like misinterpretations.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff, like there was like in French, mask, so masque, it means like mask, but when you put it with masque de ski, it's like ski goggles, or mask à oxygen is oxygen mask. Elizabeth had written mask like in a list of equipment, so I was like, oh, mask. She didn't qualify what it was, and I was thinking, oh, mask, oxygen mask, like mountaineering, it must be oxygen mask, so I put oxygen mask, when obviously she climbs in alpine style.
Oh, right, oxygen. Okay, yeah.
So luckily when I reviewed the chapter, I was like, she didn't have an oxygen mask, what are you on? And I realized that she meant goggles, masque de ski. Goggles at high altitude. But yeah, I was quite lucky I caught that one, because that could have caused some controversy that she was up on Nanga Parbat with oxygen.
sounds like the perils of a translator, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, that could have gone quite badly wrong.
Oh, well, I don't know. It sounds fascinating, you know, I think it'd be really interesting to read, you know, how you kind of got into her head. Is the translation To Live available in bookshops right now?
It's just coming back from the printers, as far as I'm aware. So it's available to pre-order. There's special editions. There's a few left, I think, on Vertebrate's website. But yeah, hopefully it'll be in the shops soonish, in the next few weeks or months. I'm not sure what the actual date is, but just keep an eye out online.
Okay, okay. Well, I'm really looking forward to reading that. I'm sure it's a fantastic book, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I really hope you get a digital crack one day.
Thank you. Me too.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. Okay, okay.
Thanks, John.
Okay, Natalie. Really nice to talk to you. All the best with your career. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Natalie Berry on Outside In. Nice to have a chance to talk to a young woman sort of setting out in a career who's, I'm sure, someone we're going to be hearing a lot more of. I just thought I'd tell you about a couple of things that I've got coming up on Outside In. I'm hoping to talk fairly soon to long-distance walker and lightweight expert Alex Roddy about his forthcoming book about some of the great long-distance walking trails in Europe. I've also, as some of you may know if you follow me on Twitter, been talking to the Cairngorm National Park Authority, and I'm asking one of them to come along on the show, and I really want to be asking questions, I suppose, about how they see the future of the national park, because I think that we really perhaps need to take a fresh look at what happens in the park. You'll probably be aware of the controversies about what happens about the Fineachera Railway and the ski development. And I think we also want to talk about issues regarding rewilding. Do get in touch if you have got questions you would like me to put to the Cairngorm National Park. It's I hope that we can maybe sort of begin to open up discussions with them about the future of that. What was a really special area. Also, you can get in touch with me if there are people that you would like me to talk to on the show. You can get in touch with me through johndburns.com or via Twitter, or just give us a good shout, really. Anyway, I really hope you've enjoyed the show today, and I look forward to you coming again. I've been John Burns. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.